Hello, and welcome to another bonus episode of the Eidetapod. Maybe not even the last extended interview of the season, it turns out. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and coming up, more from our 2022 Iditarod champion. As you may know, Brent Sass won his first Iditarod a couple days ago. It was his seventh try, but it had been a much longer road to get there. The 42-year-old musher has a lot to say about how he's forged a unique bond with his dog team, how he draws inspiration from his idols like Susan Butcher, and how his life in his remote homestead has made him the musher that he is. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan sat down with Sass along with a group of other reporters and Sass's dad Mark at the Nome Nugget newspaper in downtown Nome. There were plenty of tears and plenty of laughs during the hour-long conversation with Sass, who had napped for a few hours after winning the race earlier in the day, pretty much right down the street from the newspaper. So this is a little longer, a little more extended than some of our interviews here, but we hope you'll enjoy hearing more about Brent Sass, his lifestyle, and his race this year. He started out by describing his run from White Mountain to Nome.
I mean, I was concerned about what the run would turn into, but like at that point, we're going to Nome one way or the other. And yeah, I got Dallas behind me. Luckily, I have a little bit of a buffer. So I was, you know, that 2.5 hours ended up being enough. But yeah, I mean, it definitely, it was like, oh, here we go. Like, it's never an easy go at the end. Like, it's going to be a challenge. There's not going to be just a walk to Nome, you know. So, but we were prepared. And I mean, I had a little bit, I was just bound and determined to win this race at that point. And so I wasn't really letting it get to me. And I did a pretty good job of that the whole entire race, I feel like, is just drowning out all of the stuff. And I just had to continue doing that. So, yeah. And so we got going and it was windy and it just got progressively worse the more we got into the hills. And once we got into the, once we started climbing, it was no visibility really. I mean, you couldn't really see the leaders. You were just relying on them staying on the trail. And then you would just see all of a sudden, like the trail markers have the distance between markers perfect, because it was literally like, there's a trail marker. And then I'm just, like, hopefully we're still going in the right direction and the trail hasn't turned. There's another trail marker. It was just literally marker to marker. And then what the real challenges really started to happen was when you get up there and the trails are a little bit drifted to the side. And so you're side hilling and the wind is coming from that side and your sled is acting like a parachute basically at that point. So it was, or a sail, I should say. So yeah, it was, and I was fighting it pretty big and I had a broken runner from the night before.
And what part of the runner was broken exactly?
The actual metal, the aluminum part was cracked in half, but luckily on the dog paddle design sled, he puts a piece of plastic over the top in that area. It's right below my foot basically. So it makes it so even if it does break, it still holds together. And then the night before I had a tough time getting the runner plastic on, but with the runner plastic on the bottom and that other plastic on top, it kind of made it so the runner was still somewhat functional, but I couldn't put a whole lot of pressure on that runner because I didn't want to bust that. And if I busted that, then I would have been really screwed. So I was trying to like drive the sled on the side hill with a 50 mile an hour wind with the pressure on one runner, which was not very much fun. And so, but at one point, I mean, we kept going and it was great. And I was so proud of the dogs. I mean, they were just charging into it. Like it was amazing. Like they did not hesitate at all. They were listening to, I mean, through the wind, I was yelling commands, just G and ha. And it was like, if I said G a little bit, they would just a little bit. And they were just perfect as far as commands. And I was, so we were having a blast. It was a fun go until up one of these side hills and like the wind gusted up real high. And it caught me, and I got top heavy, and we just tumbled down off the trail into the abyss. I mean, I can show you a video of what it looked like when we got down off the trail. And we weren't very far, but the problem is that I went, and then all the dogs got drugged down with me. So now the dogs and I are just in a big pile, not very far off the trail, I hope. Like, you have no bearing on how far you've gone because you can't see anything. And so I stopped, finally got everything stopped, and the dogs like immediately just like bunkered down. Like, I'll show you the video. They like immediately just bunkered down, and the drifts are already coming over the top of them. And like, what do I do? Like, I look up, and there's the trail is gone. I don't really have any bearing of which way is where the trail is at all. So at that point, I turned a headlight on my handlebar so that I could see the sled. Because if you walked away 10 feet, the sled was gone. But with the light, you could walk away a little bit farther and see. So I turned the headlight on the handlebar, and I walked in every direction a little ways, shining, you know, and the gust would come up, and then there'd be a little bit of a lull, and you'd hope that you'd just get a reflector on a trail marker. And one of those times I did, I backtracked up maybe 25, 30 yards, and the sled went out of sight, but I had been, like, pounding my foot into the hard pack so that I had some bit of trail that I could follow. Because, like, if you just walk normally, the trail was gone immediately. So I was, like, pounding my feet in the snow so that I had these big footprints that I could follow back to the sled, because I knew that if it got too far away, I wouldn't be able to see the headlight on the handlebar either. So I found where that was, got down there, but now I've got 11 dogs who are literally bunkered down. Like, their faces are totally entrenched in snow. Like, I'm like cleaning their muzzles off because the snow and ice are just starting to build up everywhere. Their eyes are all frozen shut and everything, you know. And I'm like, how am I going to get these guys turned around, gotten back up to the trail? Because I'm like, once we're on the trail, I think I just have to keep the sled upright, and I think they'll start charging down the trail again. But at this point, they're like, we just got drugged down the mountain. Not very far, but they got drugged backwards, you know. Like, so through the chaos, I just was like talking to the dogs, and I got them all stood up, and I kind of drugged the gang line around and got the sled turned back so we were pointed towards the trail where I had found the trail. At that point, like, the insider guys that were following me had come back, and they were standing there at this point. I was like, do not touch, because I do not want this to end for me. Like, I'm fine right now. Like, I'm not in any sort of dire straits other than I need to get this dog team back on the trail before Dallas CV comes mushing by. You know, like, that in the back of my head was all I was thinking at that point. Like, it wasn't a life or death or survival thing. It was beating Dallas CV. Like, that's all that mattered at that point. And so I got them all, but like, three of them, I don't use neckline, so they're like, you know, they're running backwards, and like, that point, like, all I could do is just like be as zen as possible and not get upset with them. Because if you got upset with them at that point, they would just bunker down even more, and a, you know, 10-pound or 50-pound dog weighs 300 pounds if they want to, you know, in those situations. So I just went through and talked to them all and, you know, yelled them all, basically, because the only way they could hear you is if you're yelling. Because it was the whole time you just have this rumble going, you know, the wind's blowing out of control. And so, yeah, so I got the leaders finally, Morello and Slater, like, got the whole line all lined out. They're all facing the wrong direction. And I'm going through and lifting them up and putting them forward in their spot. And they turn around and go back down there. And for like maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes, I'm just like constantly doing that. And eventually, like, they all get like, okay, we're going to go that direction, you know. And I'm just trying to talk to him as calmly as I can in this situation. And I was pretty proud of him. And in the end, like, they trusted me. Like, I got really lucky, really lucky. And I was up there pulling the leaders, like, come on, guys. And all of a sudden, they all just, like, a light went off, and they all just started pulling, you know. And we got the sled, and I got up to where I was standing on the trail. And, you know, like I said, once I got them up on there, they were like, let's get out of here. Like, they were totally stoked on it. And then it was up to me to just keep the sled from tumbling down the mountain again. And luckily, this was all happening, as you guys know, not very far from getting out of that and down to the shelter cabin. So I didn't know that. So that was the one thing that, like, I didn't know how far I had to go still through this in order to get out to somewhat safety, you know. But we made it. And there was a last bit of pretty bad side hill. And I finally got, like, the position I could, like, be leaning over the handlebar and pushing down from the handlebar instead of on my foot on that runner, so I could use that runner without putting a bunch of pressure where it was broke, to try and keep the sled, like, kind of pointed up so it didn't go down again. It was, my arms are sore. I mean, they were sore from the race, but they're really sore now from that ordeal. But so, yeah, we got up to the top, and as soon as we kind of crested, and I looked, and I could see that there was a coast already, because it was only maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and we were there, and it was a huge relief. And I was pretty sure that Dallas hadn't come by, and got down to the shelter cabin and sort of regrouped and snacked the dogs and said, okay, guys, now we need to run up the coast. So, yeah, that's what happened. And then the coast run was just simple. You know, it was blowing and snowing a little, or, you know, a little bit of moving snow, but in the end, it's level ground there. So it felt like a cakewalk at that point. It was just cruising down the coast, and the dogs were so good. They were just, they just never, if I hadn't lost my footing and, you know, and the wind blowing me over, we would have cruised right through all that without any issue. So it was definitely my fault that we went off the edge there. But luckily we were able to pull it together just enough time to give it so I didn't have like him right on my tail, but I gave up half my lead basically in that hour or whatever that I spent trying to get myself situated. But the whole time I was like, yep, here we go, pulling his ass again, making it interesting in the last leg of the freaking race every single time. But
were you getting any updates at that point from, you know, like satellite phone, inReach, that kind of thing?
Yeah, when I got down to the shelter cabin, I messaged my buddy Mike, who I had been in touch with for a good portion of the race, giving me updates here or there, and he just said, Dallas is 11 miles behind you and moving, so get your ass in gear and get out of there. And it was, yeah. And then insider guys are loving it because they're all there watching me like get that message, and I'm like, God, I gotta get out of here right now, you know, because I didn't know what it was going to be like on the coast. Like, I didn't know if it was going to be more of that blowing snow stuff, or I've clearly been down there, you know, six times, but it's not like in the Yukon Quest, I know every inch of it. And the Iditarod, it's still sort of a little, there's all a little bit new to me still. So, yeah. So, yeah, we just had a great run into Nome.
No.
Must be a test. That's
okay. Yeah, there's.
Yeah. Was there a time when you sort of knew in your head, like, victory's in hand, I have this?
I don't think I really let it set in until I saw the city lights, and I had went through safety, and then he hadn't been through safety for like an hour, and at that point I was like, oh, okay, so like, I'm not good at math, but I did a lot of math on this trail. Like, okay, so if I'm going 5 miles an hour and he's going 7.5, then I can, you know, like those types of math was like going in my head all the time, especially in this last run. And it kind of relaxed once I saw the city lights. But of course, then it's like a long time still. So, you know, that whole time I'm kicking and still like, we got this, you know, but my anxiety went a little bit low because I was pretty all the way across the code, the blowhole and all that. I was like kicking, trying to kick and stuff like that, you know, which doesn't do you any good on that section, but I was still trying to give it every effort I could to get a little bit closer to Nome.
Is this like the same level of effort that you've done in other 1,000-mile races, or did you put in a little bit extra?
I think it's about the same. I think for me in this one, it was I put a lot more mental power into this race. I think there was a lot, like I said last night, there's just so much support that I had to somehow compartmentalize in my head and how to deal with it, because it was like, I mean, when you've got like people that are like Dallas Seavey's handlers coming up to you before the race going, you got this, you know, like, I shouldn't even say that now because Dallas is probably, what the hell, but like, you know, like everybody, so I think for me mentally, I had to really just bury that stuff and turn it into powerful energy and not be pressure. Cause one of my real good friends was just like, man, how are you dealing with the pressure right now? And I was like, well, I don't really even feel the pressure. I'm sort of burying all that into making it into energy instead of positive energy, instead of letting it be a pressure for me. So I think physically I put every race, I kind of leave it all on the table, but mentally this race was a lot more challenging for me, also because I had to lead pretty much almost the entire way. Once I passed Dallas outside of Ophir, I never saw another dog team. After I passed Dallas and Ophir, I never saw another dog team until I saw Dallas again in White Mountain.
Was it also like you wanted this one more than you've wanted other races? Is that why you were able to put in that mental effort?
I think, yeah, I mean, I think I knew that this was the time, you know, like all I had a pretty good race, a really good race season so far. And it was just one of those deals in my head. I just believed that if everything came together, that I could win this race. So, yeah, I think that was, I think I probably did, just because this was the first time I felt like I could win the Iditarod, even from the start. Like, I mean, I felt like I almost jinxed myself a few times because in the pre-interviews, you know, I never used to say like, yeah, I can win this race. Like I never, and I would, every time I'd say it, I'd be like, oh my God, like a little knot in my stomach could go in there. Like, why did you just say that? That was so stupid, you know? But then like everything else about it was like, yeah, I can win this race. Like, I'm pretty confident that we have a dog team that can win this race. So, It is about confidence. I think all this is about confidence and believing in what you got.
So you have pretty much won everything you entered this year.
I've won everything I entered this year, yeah.
And people talk about that magic carpet ride for winners of the Iditarod, and it seems like that was not an easy trail this year. No. So can you talk about your dogs? Because I think it takes that team to provide the magic carpet ride.
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, this was not a magic carpet ride. Like, it was a lot of fun, but like I've had them, like in the Quest, I've had a magic carpet ride. When I ran in 19 and 20, both of those races went pretty smoothly. Dogs ate well. Everything was going good. I mean, I finished with all of them in 19. Like, those were magic carpet rides. This one was not a magic carpet ride. It was a challenge from the get-go. It was warm, which is not our forte. Like, we're really into the cold weather, and it was 30 degrees, you know, at the beginning, and it never really got cold. I mean, when we were coming to Nome here, it was the first time I was like, wow, it feels like winter. And you could see it in the dogs. They were just like, there's so much more. I mean, they were chipper the whole way, but you could tell a difference when they're in their element, you know. So, yeah, this race was not a magic carpet ride, but like I said, we just felt super prepared, and I knew that we had the ultimate. I'm going to cry here, not with the dogs, but yeah, we just had the ultimate trust, I feel like, is what got us to the end, because they just know they knew what the job was, and they got it done. It was unbelievable. I mean, they didn't eat very well over the first, I don't know, 4 days. I was like buffet feeding them, hand feeding them, trying to get them every bit of calories I could. And that's part of the reason, like, me sleeping on the trail and doing all that, it allows me to focus all of my time and effort on that. If you stay in the checkpoint, you just don't have that time and energy because you have other distractions, or you get self-conscious about people looking at the way that you're dealing with them, and then everyone knows that your dogs aren't eating, and I'm not going to complain about that. I'm not going to whine about it. It's just what happens in a dog race. Like, sometimes the dogs don't eat, and you have to manage them the best you can, and luckily, they never lost their attitude and did just an amazing job of keeping it positive all the way through, even when they weren't feeling 100%. And like, I had all the diarrhea stuff that everybody else had, but I just didn't let it get to us. Between the dogs and I, you know, it was one of those things where we just, no excuses. It was basically what I said to myself the entire time. I was like, we can do this. Everybody's dealing with this stuff. It's warm. There isn't a dog team out here that likes to run in the warm weather, you know, and we had, and like I said, it's that connection. They just trusted in me that I was going to make the right decisions. And I made some wrong decisions that I thought were going to catch up with me along the way as well. And luckily, it didn't. And that was just because of our trust and the tremendous amount of training that we had this year.
What were those little mistakes?
Well, they weren't even that little. I mean, again, Galena is sort of my nemesis at this point. You know, in 16... that's where my problems started, when I blew through Galena in the heat of the day, and I took a lot of power out of the dogs, and then that kind of was the beginning of the fall for that problem that I had in White Mountain. And I don't know what I was thinking, but I did the same thing again this year. I came through, and I just had the momentum, and I don't like to stay in checkpoints, you know? So, like, I put the staying in checkpoints off for so long, and I had this idea in my head, Kel-Tag. I want to get to Kel-Tag for my 8 because I want to set myself up for having as much energy as possible down the trail. We had 24 late. I wanted to take that 8 in Kel-Tag, and that led to me blowing through Galena. And I didn't go very far, and it wasn't like I burned them up as far as the heat because it wasn't super hot. But when I went through Galena, that forced my hand to do some long runs in order to keep my lead. Because if I would just would have been, oh, because basically I went through Galena. I had that lead on Dallas. And he came and he stopped before Galena, which meant he was going to be 24 or 18 at one of the, either Nolato or Kel-Tag. And I knew that if I didn't do another big push, he would come and he'd see me. I did not want him to see me. Like, head games or whatever. I knew that it was driving Dallas CV crazy that he couldn't see me, that he didn't see me. And so But he's not a stupid guy, and he's not going to do some stupid thing just to see me. So, but he really would have liked to have seen me and my dog team. But I was bound and determined to try and not let that happen. So, anyways, I was camped 8 miles out of Galena or something, and I was basically, like, my plan was to go from there all the way to Caltech. And I knew that was going to be too long of a run, and I was probably going to lose some speed. And so the whole way I had opened, I brought gear and supplies and everything along. I was like, I'm just going to take a 2-hour break whenever I feel like the dogs are starting to, you know, we were going slow. It was a slog on the river. It was like one of those deals where you're just like, you're moving great. It's hard pack. It's awesome. And then all of a sudden it's like a slog and you're like in this sand and you're moving at 5 miles an hour again. And like, you just want to, you know, you just, it's crazy how the mental game set in at that point. But the dogs never lost their attitude, and that's what I'm always looking at, is we can be going 3 miles an hour and still be having a good time, but, or we can be going 10 miles an hour and have a good time. But if you're not, the attitude isn't there, then you got to know that and know when it's time to stop. And it was another one of those times where it was like, they were just like, where our training kicked in, like all those miles and all that connection and everything. They just kept marching on, and through the night, it was a long run. You know, we got into Caltech at like 2:30 in the morning. It was almost 12 hour run. But I didn't take another break in there. So I kept that small lead that I had, which was about 2 hours now at that point. And when Dallas shut it down in Nulato, but at that point now Dallas had done it right, where he had done these short runs all the way till his 8. And he had never really pushed the dogs. And I had just done this monster run right in the middle of the race to keep my lead and to keep away from him. But now I'm forced with, like, you know, what's going to happen now? Did I take that energy, that steam, like I did in 16, where it just kind of like their energy just went downhill from there? And they did great. They still ran. Everything was great. But you could tell that mentally they were wore out in 16. But we took our 8 in Caltech. And like, I mean, my secret weapon is my dogs are really calm, and they don't bark, and they don't bang in the harness, and they kind of look like they're tired all the time. And for me, I know when they're tired, and I know when they're not tired. But for someone who doesn't spend all the time with them, they basically just always look tired. And so everyone is just skeptics, because you're in Caltech, and the dogs are all just standing, and I booty them too fast and get them done ready too early, so they get iced, you know, like I call it iced, you know, like in a football game when you're not quite ready but you're all ready to go, you know. And they just stood there, and I knew at that point, just by their demeanor and their actions, that they weren't, I had not taken that edge off of them, and they were ready to go. But no one else there thought that, you know. Everyone else there was pretty sure that I had taken that edge off. I mean, like guys like Bruce Lee, who I trust tremendously. He was like, "You broke my heart when you went through Galena," you know, because, you know, and I was like, I know. And I sat there in the Caltech checkpoint, just going, "All right," I just had to believe in what we did, you know, knowing that we rode a rail there, you know. But yeah, and then we took off, and again, we weren't making breakback speed, but I knew that I had to do a short run. I knew that I couldn't do some big long run again to get to Unicleet, so I stopped at the old woman cabin and did almost a 4-hour break there. Yeah. Dallas even told me when he pulled in, as he came by there, he's like, if he saw straw there, he knew he was in trouble, because he knew that I took the conservative route and that I let the dog sort of build back up and didn't try and just continue to like build that lead. And we did. We had a great rest there, and then the dogs turned it on, and then was like the really fun part of the race, where the trail got a lot faster. Well, it turned to ice basically, so there was no more resistance, which helps that point in the race. And that run into Unicleet was just phenomenal. They were flying, their attitudes were good, their eating had turned around. The eating turned around sometime after that long run, and I think it was that long run, and in the end, that really. They basically had a turning point mentally and physically, where we either need to start eating or we're going to tank, and we're not going to, I'm not going to be, I, I'm personally, I just was like, hey, I'm either going to be able to keep the weight on them, because I had gotten some skinny dogs during that time when they had the diarrhea and weren't feeling up to par. But again, I was able to just like literally buffet feed them, hand feed them. They didn't take a snack note, so then you break it down into smaller pieces and set it in front of them. And then if they don't do that, you break it down into smaller pieces, and then you try something different. And I had been doing that all race, and then all of a sudden, you know, after Keltec, they just started hammering the food. Like, everybody's standing up. You move, you know, you got good eaters when you move the sled a little bit and they hear the bag going, and every head looks up at you. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, oh my God, we're turning the corner here. Like, this is going to happen. Like, they're going to start eating now. And they did. And they started completely plowing the food. And at that point, I was like, wow, like, we're over the hump. Now I just got to keep it on the trail, you know, literally. And, yeah, so we blew through Unicleat, tons of momentum. Dogs had lots of power. It's always a risk blowing through there because you're carrying when no one else is going to carry during that time, you know, and it's potentially bad trail. But luckily, because of the ice, you could have had 500 pounds in the sled and it wouldn't have mattered, because all you were doing was riding the brake to try and keep yourself upright. I mean, it was crazy. Coming in to Unicleat was like a maze of ice. Because they had to come around a lot of different obstacles, and they had so much rain and everything, and so you were just constantly like having to jihaw the dogs around and like cracks, and I mean, it was unbelievable, out of control the whole way. And then got in there and same leaving. I mean, it was just a nail biting run. We got up into the Blueberry Hills, and I usually stop about 6-7 miles out of town, but they were just cruising so good, and because of the ice, we were just able to keep moving. And so I knew this is where I could like either build or maintain the lead a little bit more by going as far as I could. So I said, I'm going to go to the bottom of the first hill. We got to the bottom of the first hill, and like, they were going as fast as we were going on the flats, and so I let them carry the load to the top of the hill. And so we stopped at the bottom of basically the second climb, where it really starts to climb, and we camped there. And then it was just a, you know, 3 hours. That's all I could afford at that point for rest. And we got up and went. And that run, I think this run was the one that made it for me mentally, was the one that changed everything, because I literally did nothing. I stood on the runners, and that, you've probably never been up there, but the Blueberry Hills is like one climb after another, all the way. You just think you're to the top, and then there's another one, and then there's another one, and usually you're just like, oh, and now I'm just like literally sitting on my seat, and the dogs are just charging without any hesitation. No one's looking back. It felt like you had the team that you left Willow with, you know. It was pretty exciting. And I knew then that, like, just got to hold this together to down the coast, and we're going to have a real good shot at fending him off all the way. And so we had a great run. Into Shaq, and then the next head game came into play. Like, with this whole two-way communication thing, there are no secrets on the trail. I mean, everybody knows everything, so you can't be like blowing through Shaq and think that they're not going to know you're going to go up to the shelter cabin. Like, you know, the Dallas is texting his people, where do you stop, you know? So I've been thinking about it for a long time, and I was like, no one chooses to stay on the ice, right? Like, that just generally doesn't happen. And so I had thought about it long before. I was like, that is a play that I could do, where I bet I can, like, one, spark a whole media frenzy back here that everyone thinks I blew my dog team up or something because I'm going to stop on the ice. And that'll flood back to Dallas in some way, shape, or form. And he'll take an extra hour of rest in the shelter cabin potentially because of that, because he's a smart guy and knows, like, don't push when your competitors are maybe at a low point. So some sort of strategy kind of came into my head during that time. And I was like, yeah, we're going to do it. And what I wanted to do, again, was make it so I didn't have these massive runs going into White Mountain. Like, that was my ultimate goal, was to not do big runs going into White Mountain. And by doing that extra 14 or 16 miles past the shelter cabin allowed me to make it two, like, 55-mile runs. Do that rest, do another 55-mile run, do one more rest, and then go all the way to White Mountain. Dallas, stopping back at the shelter cabin, he was faced with two 71-mile runs, which because he was already behind me a little bit and then added that other 16 miles. So it forced his hand, and I know it's not the hand that he wanted to have to play. No one wants that at that point. And so I sat there. I got to the spot where I wanted to stop on the sea ice, and I put my sled into the wind, you know, sort of parallel to the wind, and I brought the gang line around, and I just said, okay, guys, and they're super good at just, like, they all pile in on each other all the time at home, and so they all kind of got in their ball, and they're like, are we supposed to lay down now? And I just took all the straw, and I put it on the ground real quick, because they had to be standing there, because it was blowing so hard, you know, I put it on the ground, I was like, lay down, and they're like, oh, man, straw, and so they all just lay, it was the cutest thing on the planet, and so then I had all 12 dogs in a ball right on the windward side of the sled, and they had the best race of the rest of the whole race, I guarantee it, on the sea ice. I took my sleeping bag and put it out so it was kind of covering most of them, and then I put double jackets on the three or four and the fatter ones that were on the outer edge of it so that they were extra protected as much as they could, but they were already protected by everybody else, so they were getting the least of the wind and everything. And then I just hand fed them all underneath there. I made food, and I just put a bowl, got up underneath there and put a bowl down for that dog, and he ate and put down for them and got them all fed just in that position. And then snacked them a few more. They were eating really good. And by that time, so it was really fun to do that, because every time they'd look at me and say, my turn, you know, and no one, I mean, they all get along so well that they're just, it's his, that's his, and then yours will come in a minute, you know, and they were all fine with that.
Have you ever practiced that technique before of resting out on the ice with the sled over like that, or was that the first time?
No, I mean, I had camped out on the ice before, but it wasn't windy. And when it's not windy, it's fine. I mean, still people think it's crazy to camp out there, but when it's not windy, it's totally fine. But it was windy. And, I mean, the only practice we have is that we're a really cohesive team. And so when we're put in a position where we have to do something that's out of the ordinary, they're totally down with it, because everybody loves everybody and there's no animosity in there and there's no one that's going to start a fight or anything like that. And I had 100% confidence in that, and that's why you can do that, you know. So yeah, no, they rested. I think I put them in there underneath that thing like 15 minutes into the rest, and 15 minutes before the end of the rest, I got them all up and lined them all out and gave them one more big wet snack on the line and booted them up, and we took off. And it was another slog like it always is going into Koyuk, just running on a beach type thing, you know. And this is where I knew, I was like, Dallas is coming. And, you know, I think our speeds are pretty close at this point, but it's Dallas CV, and it doesn't matter how big of a lead you have. He's never going to give up. Like, he's never, ever going to wave the white flag. So I knew I just needed to keep the team moving. So we blew through Koyuk, but now I'm faced with the 55-mile runs instead of those big ones, and that was my advantage on Dallas, because his speeds were going to go down in that second 15 miles that he had to run that I didn't have to in those runs. And so, which they did a little bit, and that gave me that edge that I needed to sort of hold my lead all the way into White Mountain.
You've talked, your thing is run your own race.
Yep.
But you've talked a lot about how you're playing mind games.
Yeah, totally.
And you're talking about how there's two-way communication.
Yeah.
And you're talking about how the weather isn't quite what the dogs wanted. So.
Totally.
I hear run your own race, but I also hear, like, how much of your own race, how much of that advice did you take?
I mean, I ran my schedule that I literally to the T, I ran my schedule. So, but with this, with basically once you get to the coast, if you're not paying attention to your competition, then you're probably, I mean, unless you're like way out in front and you don't have any hope of them catching you, you have to be thinking about them. And especially when you got Dallas CV behind you, you cannot just be complacent about who he is. So yeah, I mean, it's a combination of, the biggest thing for me is run your own race. Don't even think about the competition until you get farther, and as far as like changing your schedule around until you get to the coast. And I didn't do that. Like, I knew he was back there, but I talk about Dallas a lot only because I did not want him to see me. I wanted to play that ghost. And I think that, because that gets to you. I've been that person where I've been chasing down. I mean, we were all those people. And when Thomas won, when he took off out of Keltag, and we never saw him again in that race. And so, and I knew what that did to all of us, you know, like, oh man, it's so disheartening to come into a checkpoint when you got to stop for 5 hours and the guy who's in the lead is already gone. So that's just gives you very little hope, even if you are Dallas CD. And so I knew that, like, if I could just do that. So yeah, it's a combination. I mean, I ran my own race. There is no doubt about it. But if you're when you're going up against the best, you have to have them in the back of your head, especially for that last 300 miles. And you have to know, like, make some moves that are going to maybe not be so beneficial for him, you know.
But you overlapped at White Mountain.
Yeah, of course. Yep.
There's a meme on Iditarod memes of all of the fans fighting, but you two having a nice meal together. Can you characterize?
Yeah. I mean, Dallas and I are totally kosher. Dallas and I have a history. You know, we were on a reality TV show together a few years back, and Dallas doesn't like to lose. You know, none of us like to lose. But he congratulated me in White Mountain. I mean, I was already sleeping. He came in 2.5 hours after me. I had done my dog chores. I was in the tent. And I was basically waking up from my very short sleep that I did there, because then I just fumbled around for 4 hours waiting to go. But, we had a good, I mean, he congratulated me and said, you know, heck of a dog team. And, it was friendly. It wasn't a lot of small talk, you know, but, there was a little bit at that point. Like, I think he knew that I had to mess up in order to lose. You know, but I also knew that he wasn't giving up. So.
Did he try to play any head games with you there, like just by stuff he said or anything to try to throw you off?
I don't think so. I mean, he just basically said, he's like, yeah, I was just trying to think back, you know, this is a Dallas TV comment, you know, to what it was like when I won my first one. Like, that was his comment, you know, and I was like, yeah. And so I was like, yeah, well, it's pretty exciting, you know, and, it was great. I mean, everyone's asked me, does it make it sweeter? Of course it makes it sweeter that I beat Dallas CD in this race. You know, if he's really going to go into this little retirement for a couple of years, it would have bummed me out to not get to have my Iditarod, my first Iditarod win with the best in the business that I got to beat. Like, that, you know, that's a compliment to Dallas. You know, like, he is the best right now. And we were able to stay ahead of them and beat them in a pretty exciting race, I feel like. So,
Could we maybe bring it back to the dogs? Because you said you talked about the trust earlier that the dogs have in you, and what you described earlier too was the confidence that you then in turn had in the dogs. Mm-hmm. That at the end of the race, after going through all that, that was a pretty, you know, that was college level stuff that they did coming in here. So could you maybe explain to folks, where, as a general audience, to what that means, how you instill trust in a dog team and form this team that is capable of doing that? Because not every dog team is capable of doing that. So.
I live, eat, breathe, and sleep these dogs. I don't do anything else. My entire life is devoted to them. We live together. They sleep in the cabin most of the time. Like, most people don't do that. They think it's bad for them or whatever to not be outside and the elements or whatever. But for me, it's more about the dogs just wanting to be where they want to be, and they always want to be around me. And so we spend, it's all about loose time. Like, the dogs spend most of their time free at home. You know, like, when we're going on runs, they get free and they run around for quite a while before we go on the run. We get back from a run, they run around for quite a while afterwards. And that just, I mean, everybody likes freedom, right? Everyone likes to have their own time. And dogs, I don't think sled dogs necessarily have a lot of their own time, because they're, you know, either on the line with everybody else or they're on their spot in their chain, which they're very comfortable with. And it's where my dogs spend a lot of their time. But that other time where they're able to just go off and be the dog in the corner and do whatever they want to do, and they also form relationships with each other that are stronger, I think, than what happens if you're just doing the conventional way of doing it. And so I think that is one of the, like, it's about the trust between me and them, but it's also about the trust between the two, all of them. They're all friends, and they all, like, they have buddies, and they, like, there's sibling squabbles that happen, and there's all of that normal things that happen in a family dynamic that makes the family stronger. And I feel like that part of it is why we can go do the thing on the sea ice, and why they can, like, rally together when all of a sudden the shit's hitting the fan and we're on the, you know, we've fallen off the trail in Topcock and the wind's blowing 50 miles an hour and they really just want to curl up into a ball and wait it out. But I'm sitting there going, come on, guys, we can do this. We can do this. And they, I think it's just instilled like, yeah, we can do this. We, you know, why not? Let's do it. And then one dog does it. And then that dog is best friends with the other dog that's like facing the wrong direction, but he sees his buddy doing it. So then he's like, okay, all right, I'll do it. And then he does it. And then it's just kind of like a flood. Like that's what happened. One or two dogs decided during that 20 minutes that I was trying to get them to go. One or two dogs just decided, okay, we'll do it. And then as soon as they did it, it was like a chain reaction right down the line. Like they all just decided we're going to go this direction and get out of here right now. Yeah.
So describe that group of dogs that you have. They're not young.
The oldest one is 7, Morello, the black dog that's been in the lead. She's the oldest. Most of them are 4, 5, and 6. And then there was a 2-year-old. There was 2 2-year-olds. I dropped one earlier there, Jeep. Some of you guys might know who Jeep is, the sprint dog that I got from Joey Reddington. He didn't make the team this year. He's actually running with Mott's Patterson right now. But his sibling or his kids, 2 of them made my team, and then the other 6 are with other mushers in the race right now. And they're just excellent sled dogs, but they just had no idea what they were getting themselves into. You know, they did awesome in these mid-distance races, but when you throw a dog that's 2 years old into a 1,000-mile team that wants to win, you know that dog is solid, you know, mentally and physically. So we had those guys in there, but they bring a lot of the energy. You know, young dogs bring energy to it, and that's why I left them in there all through training. And as long as they could handle it, it was clear that they were bringing more of that upbeat sort of high energy stuff to the team, which is, and not in a way of like barking and banging, just their energy is a little, it's youthful, you know, and like we all know that when you're hanging out with young people, it's just, you get that feeling. And I think it's the same way with the dogs. And then it's the core group of the orange dogs, Slater and Woody and Pink. Those 3 are really the standouts. And those guys are now 6. Their career has been, you know, 2 Yukon Quest wins, a 3rd and a 4th place in Iditarod, and now a win in the Iditarod. Like, those are the 5,000-mile races that they've run are those. And they've all 3 finished all of those races. And then after that, it's, I mean, everybody, first off, with an exception of the 2 sprint dogs, are all connected back to silver. So all the genetics are all, they're all very similar in genetics. They're cohesive that way, and I think that really helps genetically, being so connected. Their brains work the same, and it's like a family, real family, not like a bunch of different stuff kind of put, not like a blend. I mean, blended families work, but it's not quite the same when they're all really blood connected. And I feel like with this team, there's a lot of that. And they've all been raised all together, you know, like the core of the team had been in all these races, and then the other ones have been sort of inserted in. There were 3 of them that had never run a 1,000-mile race that were just turned 4 that had been kind of on the B teams and kind of lurking for the last 2 years. And they just stepped it up and rose to the occasion in this. And they, all 3 of them finished. And Marble and Garnet are the 2 main ones. And then Jackson and Tock are the other 2 that are just really awesome sled dogs that have just risen to the occasion when really needed. And they never been in a 1,000-mile race, especially Garnet and Marble. And they just, it was just so fun seeing them be excited at the end, you know, or even 800, 700 miles in, you know, that's when you start to think, okay, I never go into a race expecting to drop dogs. Like, I train dogs so that they can run 1,000 miles. Like, that is my ultimate goal. But I also have to be realistic in dogs that have never run a 1,000-mile race, what they're going to feel like at 700 miles into a race like this. We're not just running it. We're running to win it. And so...
So 3 out of the 4 have been to the finish line now?
Yep.
What do you think is going on in their mind now that you guys have like run just for 8 days, and that's like what you do. You run and you run some more, and then you run some more, and then it's coming to an end. And you talked about that yesterday, where you said, my dream was to win the Iditarod and win the Yukon Quest, and now I've done it, and it felt like, and now what?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit. Come back and win again. That's the goal. but I think in the end, I wish I had the answer to that. I don't know exactly if they care about any of that. You know, I think in the end, they're just out there doing what they love to do, and they're following my lead, and they're riding my emotional roller coaster. And I think they felt the ease fall away when we saw the city lights, just like it did. I mean, the intensity level was high for the last 300 miles, trying to stay more than it is any time during the season, and they knew it, and they all rose to the occasion. But I feel like they also let that sigh of relief go. And for what reason? I don't know. I mean, they know they won this race probably, but I don't think they really care. I really don't think they care much. I think that they are just doing what they were trained to do, what they love to do, what they're instinctually meant to do, and they're trying to please me. So
I always ask almost everyone, when you come at the end of the journey and you get over Cape Nome and you see the lights of Nome.
Yeah. So. It was an amazing morning. I was thinking about all the people and everybody that has helped me over the years to make all this happen, and it's just an endless list of friends and family and dogs, other dogs, all my teams before. Like, they're the ones that taught me all the stuff that I know now. But yeah, it was totally overwhelming. I had a lot of people, like, you know, Susan Butcher and Joey Reddington and Hobo Jim were three of the people that I wish they could have been here to see it. You know, like that. Those people are very influential in all of this. And it was reflecting on them a lot was a lot throughout the race. Because they were huge. I mean, Hobo, just a huge inspiration with his music and the friendship that we built over the years with singing Wild and Free, how I embodied all of my everything. And then Joey Reddington is just my favorite human on the planet and just a dog mentor. And then Susan, I mean, I got to be with her in the last years that she worked with dogs. And I was just beginning and didn't have a clue as to anything. And I still don't know that I remember, like, factually remember anything that she said, but it was about the aura that she brought to you know, I got to go run her dogs and then come back and sit down in their living room. And she'd be like, okay, tell me, this is when she couldn't do it anymore. You really like, how'd the dogs do? Tell me what they did. Explain to me what they did. And then we would do that. And then she would tell us what to do differently next or how to react to this or do with that. And at the time I was just soaking in the information and then going and regurgitating it out on the dogs. Like, okay, Susan said to do this or whatever. And I, you know, now looking back, I realize how monumental all of that was. And her history and the Iditarod, you know, and all that. I mean, it's pretty, pretty awesome. Yeah, so it was special coming in, though, for sure. Yeah. Sorry. That'll make everybody cry, probably.
That's, you know, for running such a big race and as a team with another species, and covering all that ground, what I wonder is, like, how do you keep your stuff together for the dogs? Because they're feeding on your energy.
Yeah.
You just can never lose it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of times I'm feeding on their energy as well. Mm-hmm. I think it's a give and take. Because there's definitely times where when I thought I had made the big mistake, when I thought I had made a wrong decision on my run, you know, coming into Caltech and everything, it was them that said, nope, we're good. Mm-hmm. Everything's good. Like, we still got the energy. We can go forth. We're not in any, you didn't take that edge off of us. Like, they were the ones that pulled me, whether they knew it or not. They were just being themselves. And it was their energy then that I was like, wow. Like, yeah, I think we're still in a good position. But if they would have been portraying a different feeling, if I would have taken that edge off, if I would have had a bunch of tired dogs, who knows? My attitude could have started to tumble, and then after that, things go downhill. So I think it's a give and a take. I think they really helped me And then I think a lot of it is just reflecting on all these people that have been a part of this and helped me, you know, like, one, it's not really wanting to let them down, but it's more of just wanting to, like, carry on their spirit in a positive way.
So, and how do you turn them, maybe carry on, like, now you're the champion or not the recipient of information? How do you think you could impart some of the wisdom or some of the stoke of mushing to generations that come after?
Yeah, I mean, telling the story the way it is, like I'm doing right now, I feel like it's not all about winning. I mean, this was not about winning. This was about proving that we, you know, have a really good dog team and that we're a really good team and that we can go out and accomplish whatever we set out to do. And winning happened to be the goal on this race. But in the end, I enjoy everything that I do. And I feel like that's what people need to realize is that if I would have lost to Dallas Evie, it would have been extremely disappointing for a little while. And then I would have realized that we got second in the greatest race on the planet. And it would have been pretty cool, you know. And then you would have moved on and tried to win next year. So I think that it can't be if I'm going to give any advice, it can't be focused on only the win. It's about the journey. It's about all that it took to get to this point. And then all the stuff that we're going to do after this, you know. Like, this is just the beginning, I feel like. It's always just the beginning, but the training for me and the lifestyle is the most important thing. Like, I thoroughly enjoy what I do and am very fortunate for what I have as a life, and the dogs make that possible. So the race is just something that we do along the way to prove, maybe. It's a proving ground for all the training and the life that we live, and we're able to come out here and prove, like, yeah, we're living the dream, and we're also at the top of our field. So, yeah.
Well, actually, I have one more question.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
No worries. Keep going. I'm going to roll now.
Living the dream. I know. I'm sorry. I'm a grown man crying. So, living the dream, you live in a pretty isolated homestead. And I think sometimes it doesn't feel like living the dream when the car breaks down and you have to shovel yourself out. So can you maybe, just in a short explainer, say how you live and what the challenges are to have dogs in the place where you have them?
Well, I live about 150 miles northwest of Fairbanks at an old homestead. It's the same place that Susan Butcher and Rick Swenson trained back in their heydays. And
it's it's a 150-mile drive, and then isn't it a snow machine?
Yep, and then you get a snow machine about 7 miles into my place. Yeah, in the wintertime, it's not full access, so you have to get there, park in a parking lot, and then drive a snow machine or dog team into the place. We're totally self-sufficient, run generator, solar power. I haul all the dog food up there. I mean, the food drive, it's kind of like a oxymoron. You haul thousands of pounds up there, and then you feed it some of it, and then sort it all out, and then you haul it all back to town for food as food drops and stuff. So there's just all this extra effort. But I don't want to spend time in town anymore. It's gotten to the point where, like, I just love the struggle. It's a struggle. There's no doubt. It's a struggle. But I enjoy the struggle. I enjoy not really knowing what every day is going to hold. Not knowing that something's going to blow up, something's going to break, something's not going to go right is, and I think that's part of the reason that we're such good racers, is because my life is kind of like one big dog race. Like, every, you're kind of constantly tasked with a new challenge and with a different thing that happens every day, and a dog race is the same way. So, like, my daily life just sort of prepares me for that. I mean, for the first time in 10 years, I had to shut the homes. I didn't have any help this year. I didn't have any consistent help. I had some people come up and save my butt. But I was alone at the homestead for a good portion of the season, which is a tremendous amount of work. But I also feel like that was one of the main reasons for some of our success, because I did literally everything with the dogs. There was no handler to feed them when I was away. I was never away. There was no handler that there was a old handler of mine, a past handler that came, and she totally saved my butt and helped me run the dogs for a month and a half and keep the miles on them. But for the most part, I did all of the training for the dogs, and that I know is making a big difference. And the ability to do that is because I live at a homestead in the middle of nowhere, and I don't have to like drive my truck every day, and I don't have to go to the store every day, and there's no social pressure. That's the downside, is that I do lose tact with friends, and I'm not as in tuned in the social world because I live out there. But because of that, everything is focused on the dogs. And I think that's the main reason that my success has been over the last 10 years, is because I've chosen this life where it's survival and dogs. And that's what I do. I try and survive, and I run dogs. And when shit hits the fan, I have a tremendous amount of people that help, you know, from my dad to my mom, who are there if they need some business transaction to happen that I can't make happen out there. They are always there to help. And my dad comes up for months at a time to come help, you know, fix trucks and stuff. And then on top of that, I have friends in Fairbanks that'll do anything at a drop of a hat for me, you know. And I try not to call on that, but they're there. And when I do need it, they're always there. And so that really helps. I don't do this all alone. I never want the myth that I'm like this crazy person who does everything on his own. I mean, on the ground, I do most of it. But there's a huge network of people that are helping me do it all. But yeah, and then, I mean, I just got a message from I ended up buying this homestead from Ed and Will Salter, who were there living there during the time when Rick and Susan and that whole dog culture was out in Eureka, and they were all thriving out there. And my ultimate goal was always to, you know, bring the trophy back to Eureka. Because there's, if you count it up now, there's five Iditarod championships from Rick Swenson, four from Susan Butcher, three Yukon Quest championships from me, one from Dave Monson, and now another one from Iditarod. So there's 10 Iditarod championships and 4 Yukon Quest championships, all won on training on those trails out in Eureka, which is
a little shrine there.
Yeah, which is pretty awesome. Yeah. And I'm so proud to be carrying that tradition on. Like I take a lot of pride in that. So yeah, I mean, it's a lifestyle, and you have to want to work pretty much all the time. And, I'm just fortunate that I have the capabilities of doing that right now. And I hope that for a lot of years to come, I can do it and I can streamline. This will help. A little bit of money always helps to streamline a few things at the homestead, maybe improve some stuff so that my life isn't so crazy. And then I can just put more time into the dogs.
And then I have a question for Dad. Do you think he'll outgrow the face, or?
I don't know what to say. I just appreciate being able to listen to hear say somebody else, because we have our own relationship, and my job is to help him pull off what he wants to do. And I just, my motto in life is, you got to go for it. You got to make it happen. If you don't take a risk, you're not going anywhere.
I mean, he's a workaholic, so I got it from him. You know, I got all of this from him, probably. But
it's pretty neat. That's all I can say. It's, I don't know. I guess I've been doing it 24 years straight, never ever missed. I come up in January. I don't go back till end of May, April, May, and it's kind of like, He's doing what he loves. And I sat down one day and said, why, Brent, you got to lighten up a little bit. You got to have another life. I said, Dad, you don't understand. This is my life. And you know what? I respect that. And I do what I have been fortunate and blessed in my world. And here we are. I'm just really, really proud.
I'm done making you cry.
All right. Around every corner, yeah. No. No, it's been good. It's good to put it all out there. Yeah. You know, I think about this stuff a lot, yeah. But it's different to say it all.
Well, it's a long summer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's
good. And you're going into that long summer with a championship under your belt, no regrets, and other people who have scratched.
Yeah.
Or who put everything into it and they had to abandon the race. They have a long summer ahead of them too.
Yep.
So do you have any advice as like a round that you have experienced every emotion on that?
I know all about the summer afterwards. Focus forward. That's what I tell everyone. Focus forward. Forget about the past. I mean, you can't forget about the past. You got to learn from all your mistakes and learn from all that. But the best thing you can do is just start thinking about next year. Start thinking about tomorrow and not think about yesterday. that's the best advice. And, you know, keep your attitude. That's the second your attitude goes away, you're in trouble. Positive attitude is key. And I think that for me has been key. And that's like my life in general. I mean, if I get upset every time something breaks, I would be in trouble. I wouldn't be alive right now if I got upset every time something broke. And like again, I think that's why my life just lends right into dog racing, because it is just one big dog race is what my life is.
We have our headline, right?
That was 2022 Iditarod champ Brent Sass in an interview Tuesday, a little while after he'd won the race. You can find video, by the way, of the ridiculous conditions with the heavy wind as Sass was trying to get to Nome to secure that victory. That's on our website, alaskapublic.org, along with a whole bunch more content about the Iditarod. We'll also be working on another bonus episode with an extended interview from longtime Iditarod musher Aaron Burmeister, who finished his 21st race this year and says he's stepping away from competitive mushing now. Look for that coming up in your podcast feeds. Until then, I'm your host, Casey Grove, and thanks for listening.